Hi, this is Paul. The Ayaan Hirsi Ali Christianity conversation continues to churn on the internet. Some people have been sending me some interesting things. Genetically Modified Skeptic, who I don't follow at all, had a video on her. I just saw that Rationality Rules, who I keep up with a little bit more. He had a video on her. Before we get into any of neither of these people looked at the Unheard interview. Now, I talked about this video before. It was behind their paywall. Now it is out in the open, and I will play you the part that refers to the personal aspect of her conversion, where she addresses what these people address directly.
A lot of people were also questioning what appeared to be a more of a sort of practical way of making your faith decisions. That was very discussed. I mean, the article has been read many hundreds of thousands of times already since Friday, and no doubt will continue to be. But I did notice that as a common response, which is, it felt like a justification or a discussion of Christianity as a mechanism to resist cultural collapse, almost. Mm-hmm. And there was not so much of a personal journey, not so much about your own faith. Is there anything that you would expand on there?
The reason why I care, first of all, you have, you know, a limit on the number of words that you want to publish.
Yeah.
On her. and I'm expanding this into a book, but yes, there's a very personal story. I don't know to what.
Oh, I caught it that time. She's expanding this into a book, so she's writing another book, which I'm super excited about because this will be an interesting book. So I guess now once people recognize that, they'll say, oh, her conversion isn't genuine, sincere. Again, take a look at Hans-Georg Müller's Age of Sincerity. Sincerity is sort of the old, where you're fulfilling family duties. No, so that's not sincerity. Authenticity is where it relates to what you feel like is true deep down inside of you. And that's why when I made the little video the same day I released the first one, I said her conversion is authentic because this is what she feels down deep in her heart.
What extent it's useful. But on a very personal level, I went through a period of crisis, very personal crisis of fear, anxiety, depression. I went to the best therapists money can pay. I think they gave me an explanation of some of the things that I was struggling with. But I continued to have this big spiritual hall or need, as you call it. I tried to self-medicate. I tried to sedate myself. I drank enough alcohol you could use to sterilize a hospital. Nothing helped. I continued to read, you know, books on psychiatry and the brain, and none of that helped. All of that explained a small piece of the puzzle, but there was still something that I was missing. And then I think it was one therapist who said to me early this year, I think, Ayaan, you're spiritually bankrupt. And at that point, I was in a place where I had sort of given up hope. I was in this place of darkness, and I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to open myself to that and see, you know, ask her, what are you talking about? And we started talking about faith and a belief in God, and I explained to her that the God I grew up with was a horror show. He created you to punish you and frightened you, and you know, as a girl and as a woman, you're just a piece of trash. And so I said to her, I explained to her why I didn't believe in God, and more than that, why I actually hated God. And then she asked me to design my own God, and she said, if you had the power to, you know, attribute a higher power, if you had the power to make your own God, what would you do? And as I was going on, I thought, yeah, right. That's actually a description of Jesus Christ and Christianity at its best. And so instead of inventing yet another new God, I started diving into that story. And so far, you know, my husband and I went about, both of us saying we're atheists, and now it's, I like this story, I exploit, and the more I look at it, the more, I don't want to say I'm fulfilled, but I feel I no longer have this need, this void, I have to say, and I feel like I'm going somewhere. Mm. There are standards that I have to live by that are quite high, and that's daunting. But these are standards that I'd rather aspire to and fail. Maybe the only human being who nearly achieved that was the late Queen Elizabeth. But trying to emulate her is this daily practice of hardship.
Well, she never did interviews, so that was makes it easier.
Yeah. But that's, you know, service and duty and selflessness and check your urges and your impulses and your anger and your resentment and your pride. I find these things much more appealing. Hmm. Then go and convert the others, and if they refuse.
How should those of us who are not...
Okay, so I think that's... To me, she is completely... Now, I'm not using Mueller's terminology when I say sincere, because she is sincere. I mean, she means it. I think she's being honest, and I think it's authentic in that. I think she is telling us what she feels in her heart. Now, the response has been very interesting because, okay, this is political. Okay, well, what exactly do you mean by political? That it's somehow politically motivated? And now that they hear that she's got a book out and that book is going to sell, well, maybe it's mercenary. Maybe it's about the money. And I think when it comes to human motivation, I think it's important to recognize that all of our motivations are complex, and she obviously is taking a great deal of risk doing this because she will touch off a firestorm, which she already has done in some ways, and she will be criticized. She got a letter from Richard Dawkins, an open letter, which Grim Grizz read. I'll put the link below if I don't even just play some of Grim Grizz's reading of the letter. And well, let's address the motivational issue, first of all. And I think Glenn Scrivener, in his response to this, and again, most of the initial responses were from the Unheard article. They weren't from this interview. This interview came a little later. It was behind the paywall. So the interview hasn't really been sort of digested by the zeitgeist in terms of thinking about this topic.
And so she points to various geopolitical changes. And this has led some people to cynically kind of put on Twitter, you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali says, why am I a Christian? Global politics. I think that would be to misunderstand the essay and the importance of the moment. But she does absolutely point to geopolitical forces as defining the moment that we are in. Now, does that mean that her turn towards something Christian is entirely cynical or hypocritical or sub-Christian? Now, it could be any of those things, obviously. But I put it to you that anyone who shows up in church on a Sunday will have mixed motives. Whether it's me, whether it's a professional Christian like me, whether it's Christians who've been Christians for many years, or whether it's your average secular person showing up trying to give church a go, guess what? Their reasons for showing up in church on Sunday will not be, I just want to worship the living God. Guess what? Their reasons will be, my marriage has just fallen apart and I'm all out of ideas, and I'm just going to give this church thing a shot. Or they'll come and they'll talk about depression. They've fallen flat on their face in depression. Or redundancy has struck them and they've wondered what it's all about. Or they actually fancy a girl and they're kind of coming along with their girlfriend and they're not really sure about it. Or the sense of community that they've seen in church is far greater than anything they've seen outside. Or even if you come to church and you say, well, actually, I don't want to go to hell, so I want to figure out whether I can get out of hell free with this Jesus figure. Guess what? That is also, to some degree, a prosperity gospel. It just has a much longer time horizon, right? There's a prosperity gospel. You've got much more delayed gratification with that kind of prosperity gospel. But even if the only reason you're coming to church is so that you can deal with the judgment of God and instead escape to heaven, guess what? That is not the highest reason to come to church either, right? The highest reason to come to church is Jesus, right? I want to worship Jesus. I want to hear his voice. I want to belong to his body. Now, those would be ultimately the reasons that you come to church. But be honest, even if you're a Christian, is that the reason you go on a Sunday morning?
I told Rafe he was the coolest guy at ARC, and I told Glenn he was the cleverest guy at ARC, because I do think that, and I'm going to have a conversation with Glenn coming up quite soon, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this. But Glenn's exactly right here. Now, again, why do many people, what's sort of eating them about this? Now, I think a lot of it is sort of this idea that Christians are taking a tribal victory lap, and they're really annoyed watching this. So they're going to make a video that they don't really want to say, I'm really annoyed watching Christians take a victory lap in this little tribal rivalry we have going in this mimetic rivalry. So then I listened to some of the videos about, okay, what exactly is your contention here that, well, first of all, she wouldn't actually have to go to church to say that she's a Christian, because trust me, there are many, many, many people who identify as Christian who don't bother going to church. So the fact that she is going to church indicates something about where she would like to go, or who she would like to become, or what she would like to know. But to me, part of what was really interesting listening to these professional atheists, almost aspiring celebrity atheists, let's say, is, okay, what exactly is this about? The main point seems to be for them about, of course, the supernatural, because this, whenever they say, well, atheism isn't really about a worldview, there's a reason we're all a little skeptical about that, because this claim to atheism or agnosticism, at least on the lips of many of these individuals, is in fact about a worldview. It's about what is or is not possible. It's about what is or is not true. And then they say, well, AHA, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, has not basically crossed a line with respect to this. And this is the line that we have, and this is the line we are policing.
A notable thing about this article is that it has nothing to do with her belief in the supernatural at all. She doesn't mention or even allude to that she believes in, much less loves, Jesus or God. Rather, it seems that she has decided to join Christianity because she finds secular approaches to existential questions and political problems to be too ineffective for her. She thinks Christianity is a better toolkit to answer these problems. This paragraph, I think, could be called the thesis of her article. In this nihilistic vacuum, referring to the secular world here, the challenge before us becomes civilizational. We can't withstand China, Russia, and Iran if we can't explain to our populations why it matters that we do. We can't fight woke ideology if we can't defend the civilization that it is determined to destroy. And we can't counter Islamism with purely secular tools. To win the hearts and minds of Muslims here in the West, we have to offer them something more than videos on TikTok. Videos on TikTok is what the secular world offers, apparently. Yeah, never mind the actual giant nonprofit organizations that do actual boots on the ground and legal work and have invited Ayaan to speak for them many times in her career.
And now he's basically going to go into actions, because he says basically, well, he also basically says that, well, this complaint about wokeism is a big nothing. And this then is his big point.
My take on the conversion bit, though. What about Ayaan has actually changed? Have her political positions changed? I don't think so. Have her political allies changed? No, again, I don't think that they have. She just identifies as a Christian now and sees Christianity as a tool to accomplish the political goals that she's already had for quite a while now. Honestly, her conversion in itself is not very interesting. It's not that big of a change, actually. She does not seem to be a...
But yet we're making videos about it.
...substantially different person. What is actually interesting, I think, is what her conversion and the reaction to her conversion tells us about religion in the developed world in 2023. When people leave Christianity, especially evangelical Christians, are very quick to say that those people were never true Christians at all, or that their reason for leaving is totally invalid. And yet, without even alluding to the idea that she believes in an actual, literal, dying and rising Jesus Christ...
Okay, back to policing the natural, supernatural line. Modernity, in other words.
Ayaan is accepted just because she wants to call herself a Christian. This indicates to me, at least, that such Christians care a lot more about a label or conservative politics than they do about anyone actually upholding a specific supernaturalist doctrine.
Okay, back to the supernaturalism. And you're not going to get an argument out of me that a bunch of Christians aren't spending way too much time looking at labels. But again, back to policing the supernatural line.
Avowing Christianity is becoming a way to say that you are politically conservative and might have more to do with politics than supernatural beliefs. I don't say this to insult or undermine Christianity in any way. I don't find Christianity more or less valid as a political identity than a spiritual or religious identity.
But he does have his political identity and his political preferences, as do we all. It's part of what democracy affords. You can have your political opinions.
For me, this is a neutral observation about the reality of our culture right now. I mean, atheist, as I've said on my channel many, many times, is, in the context of the U.S., a political identifier. The vast majority of self-described atheists in the U.S. are politically progressive, and atheists are the most politically active religious identity group in the country.
Oh, this is interesting. And, of course, it's something we all knew. So, if... Ayaan Hirsi Ali is not a real Christian because she's engaging in a political conversation with this identification, then is it fair to say that atheists aren't real atheists because they're engaging in a political game with this new identification? And this, of course, goes back to Jordan Peterson saying to Sam Harris, are you really an atheist?
The term atheist does have something to do with believing or not believing in a god, yes, but the political aspect of that term, I think, is just as important sociologically in defining a community and binding people together under one label. This aspect...
The difficulty, of course, with this, with binding people together under a label, is that almost all you have is the label. It's a similar thing to the LGBTQIA++, where you're all under a label. And Jordan Peterson makes the observation that, well, they are all identifying with respect to sexual function in some way. But as a label, atheist, again, we've got the dissonance with an atheism. Atheism doesn't mean a worldview. It's just that I'm not believing in something. Or atheism is, in fact, a political category. Then there's this strange guy. I hear he eats potato chips when he's trying to make videos. In the 90s, I did a lot of reading in church growth movement. And Lyle Shaler, who was one of the early founders, basically said, countercultural, meaning conservative usually, countercultural churches grow. because, you know, if you don't have the prevailing winds of a political party or a culture behind you, you need a community in which to maintain your ideals and to have them reinforced and encouraged. And so countercultural churches always have more enthusiasm and energy. Part of what I think all religious groups are dealing with in a place like North America is we're increasingly competing in real time. Physical groups are competing against the internet. Like I said, I've got a church of 60, 80 people, and I've got an online following of thousands. And there, you know, a lot of people online think, well, when is Vanderclay going to give up his local church? And I keep telling them, no, actually, the local church is where it's at. And the online thing is sort of a hobby. It seems strange. The other point to come back around too, I think, even though it's very true that in religious communities, people will have a lot of fighting about how Jesus feels about LGBTQ inclusion or how Jesus feels about abortion, the idea that there is a Jesus and he has an opinion tends to generate or tends to energize the conversation and the debate and even the conflict in a way that I think, again, is difficult if you don't actually have a person who is deciding that everyone spends a great deal of time singing and praying their love to. So I think that's another part of, there are many, many layers to what we're dealing with here, both religious and non-religious.
For more conversation.
This was my conversation partner.
Sure, because it could be a very long story. But I grew up in Southwest London, and I grew up in a non-religious family. Neither of my parents were religious. They weren't kind of strong new atheist types, but they didn't go to church. They never professed religion in their life. And so it was never really a part of my life. And I never would have imagined when I was a kid that I would be leading a congregation as my profession. It just wasn't an option. It wasn't something I considered. But I got very involved in the humanist community at Harvard when I was a grad student. I graduated from Cambridge. I was a high school teacher for a little bit in London. I was a terrible teacher. I mean, truly disastrous teacher. So I retreated back to grad school and moved across the pond to the United States to study education. And there I found like that my religious views, not being religious, was just a lot less common in the United States than it is in England. And I felt the need to be around people who were a little bit more like me in terms of my religious values. And that drew me to the humanist communities on campus, which are pretty vibrant. There are a lot of non-religious people on Harvard's campus, and they've got some really great support, particularly from Greg Epstein, who I know you've had on the show, who wrote that book, Good Without God. He's their the humanist chaplain there. And I got to know Greg shortly after I got on campus. And that community became a big part of my life. They were people who, you know, I went to when I was struggling with things. But I think a similar experience that many people would have with their religious community, this humanist community provided for me. I even ended up coming out of the closet to them on a service trip to New Orleans after Katrina. And so they really provided me with an extraordinary amount of support at a time in my life when I really needed it. And what I slowly realized was that the things that I was doing with that community were becoming more vital for me than my academic work, and they were where more of my attention was focused. And it happened to be the case that at that time, we were trying to create a real congregational community for humanists on campus. It didn't exist yet, but we had an idea that there could be something like an analog of a church or a temple for people who were not traditionally religious, but wanted a community based around shared values. And so I was part of building that community, and it became a real place. You know, for a while we had a real space where people would come on Sunday and we had talks mm-hmm. and music. And I just loved the community that we were able to build. And so when I first encountered ethical culture, which is the very old fashioned name for the movement I'm a part of, which is a network of humanist congregations, I realized I could make a career out of what had become my passion. And I experienced a calling, honestly. I visited the New York Society for Ethical Culture, and I remember walking out onto the stage, gorgeous Art Nouveau like dark wood walls and this beautiful plush velvet seats. And I had the most profound sense that it was my mission in life to fill it with people. And I had never encountered something like that before, the sense that I had a mission in life and I knew exactly what it was. Mm. And that day I inquired about training to become clergy in the movement. Leader is our very pompous term for our clergy. And that took me to St. Louis, where I completed my training. And very foolishly, they hired me to be first their sort of equivalent of an associate pastor. And then I took over as their lead pastor. Yeah. In the middle of COVID. It was a fantastic time to take over the leadership of a congregation.
Wow. Yeah. What a time to be put in that role. Gosh. Well, we'll hear about, you know, what that's all.
Basically, it all happened. And I told him, I said, this should be, I mean, with the rise of the nuns, you guys should be bursting out. You should be growing like crazy. I mean, you can go to a place like Roseville, Rockland in Sacramento and find, you know, these mega churches. Where are the humanist ethical mega churches? Well, they're not there. In fact, these little ethical societies are struggling. There's a reason Ayaan Hirsi Ali, maybe if they had these little ethical congregations, maybe Ayaan Hirsi Ali could have gone there and found salve for her soul and found meaning and all of these. The Freedom From Religion organization usually puts up bullet. I don't know if they have enough money anymore because they don't seem to put up the billboards anymore. This is what, for a couple of years at least, they put up in Sacramento. God-free, happy, and inspired by wonder. Will Scarf, Sacramento, technology analyst, atheist, Freedom From Religion Foundation. But apparently they can't get any momentum because, well, maybe they just don't need to be.
Aspect of the term actually motivates me to call myself an atheist, even when I could accurately describe myself as an agnostic. This is also why when someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali stops identifying as an atheist, I don't really care. I already don't consider myself to be particularly aligned with her because, for me, what people actually do, in this case politically, matters way more to me than their...
Again, new atheism was always political. This is the heart of it.
Metaphysical beliefs or what label they choose to put on that. I mean, when you call advocating for the safety and rights of minorities cult-like behavior, unless I guess you're advocating for ex-Muslims, how does this work? Then I'm going to consider that to be a much bigger issue than whether or not you believe in a god. I would much, much rather work with a self-described Christian who shares common values and goals with me than work with an atheist who doesn't. I think this is very obvious when you take a look at just how many times I have had scholars who happen to be Christian on my channel to advocate for a broader, deeper understanding of biblical texts and social issues. For me, it's not the label. It's what's on the inside that counts. So, do I...
In another place in the video, he basically says, well, you know, all of these things for championing minorities, woke has always been around. And it's like, really? No. I grew up in a racial reconciliation church. I watched and lived racial integration in Paterson, New Jersey. My parents moved into the neighborhood, sacrificed for that. And when I saw this new wave of wokeism coming up, I thought, They are promoting a racial essentialism that is going to re-racialize young people's imagination, and racism is going to be reseeded in the culture, and we have been seeing that. And the reason that, well, I don't know if genetically modified skeptic is on the same side as Richard Dawkins, but what's happening in this whole thing, it's getting scrambled because, well, where are the sides? Just today, my little video that I did with Peter Boghossian came out. And here we are on the banks of the Thames, just having a lovely time together. And Peter Boghossian, of course, you know, is in this whole inverted world. And if you really want to watch something about this, listen to Peter Boghossian talk with David Silverman. I mean, it's quite an interesting conversation. Now, Rationality Rules has an interesting thesis in this, that this is actually evidence of the weakness of Christianity, because in the good old days, Christians that would divide on doctrine would kill each other. And so Christianity is actually much weaker. I guess Islam is therefore stronger. And I'm a little puzzled by the rationality of all of this. But he's happy that in her personal life she's found something.
Age. We not only have the wishy-washy, deeply metaphorical Christianity of Jordan Peterson, but also the outright political Christianity of Ali. Christianity has become so weak that it not only accepts such conversions, but celebrates them. So personally, I think that Ali's conversion is a very good sign. For one, it seems that she finds great solace in what she calls Christianity, and I want nothing but happiness for her. She is a brave person who has led a very difficult life, and if she can find even a small measure of peace from Christianity, then I wish her nothing but the best. I genuinely hope that all of those visits to church do her soul well. And as for Christianity as a whole, I can't understate how wild things are. I'd pay great money to see what St. Augustine and Aquinas would make of Peterson and Ali. I mean, they possess disdain for Ali simply because she's a...
What I don't think he understands is that Augustine and Aquinas knew people and understood the care of the soul. Because if pastors are just sacks of ideas promoting this or that, instead of, well, actually caring for people who are come into the church, come into the fold, as Glenn Scrivener said, with all of these different motivations, sitting down and, well, let's talk. Let's talk about it. Well, okay. Maybe you're wobbly. Maybe you're skeptical about Jesus rising physically from the dead. Maybe you've got questions about the morality of the Bible. Maybe you've got all of that. Well, let's continue the conversation. To me, that's not a sign of weakness. That's a sign of confidence and strength of what we know about ourselves. I mentioned this episode, and it has always been political. New atheism has always been political.
The God of the Old Testament. I know both you gents, Josh and Chris, want to come back on this. And perhaps we'll start with you, Josh, sure. as a Jew. Did you sort of get where the former chief rabbi, Lord Sacks, was coming from in saying that?
For what it's worth, I didn't read that as being remotely anti-Semitic. I read The God Delusion like lots of people involved in liberal religion did, because actually we're grappling with the same issues that Richard is grappling with. I was irritated by bits of it.
Now, again, this is a liberal rabbi, and they're right up front with that at the beginning of the podcast. And, of course, my friend Jacob, we call him a rabbit and not a rabbi, because, yes, Christians fight amongst themselves, as do Jews, as do Muslims, as does everyone.
I enjoyed bits of it. I was offended by none of it. What I was concerned about was how simplistic that line is, because...
Now, I'm still waiting for the Alistair McGrath. Now, I'm interrupting this, and for those of you who are new to the channel, this is what I do. This video is without me, and it's got way more views than this video. The link to this video is below, so if you want to watch this conversation in its entirety, I recommend it, but I am going to interrupt it because that's sort of the shtick here of using these as examples and footnotes for my overall argument that might be a little bit convoluted. Because yes, this is me.
Fails to recognize is that the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, is not univocal. It has a number of different texts within it, and it has a number of different versions of how we can understand God within it. Inevitably, because it's...
Now, I'm going to make a point about this point, because of course we're a crazy clover leaf. The question of this is always one of, well, does that mean that the Bible doesn't have authority? Does that mean that the Bible isn't inspired? And of course, this is a conversation within Christianity about how the Bible works, how it's supposed to work among us, whether the Bible is, as many people, especially outside the faith and some within it, say, well, the Bible is a list of rules that must be followed by the people. Well, there are rules in the Bible. And yes, there's certainly, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, Jesus says. So there certainly is that dimension. But the Bible also is a conversation in which the Bible is helping those who are listening and submitting and following and learning in the context of the church understand the way the world works. Because often, we can use opponent processing here as an illustration, often the way to sort of get at something is to sort of listen to both sides. And so often what the church actually does is steward a conversation where people can learn and grow. And again, as I can't really blame atheists for not understanding what goes on in church or what pastors do, we actually steward people through conversations, as do rabbis, apparently, which doesn't surprise me at all.
It's a product of different people in different times grappling with those very issues. So the vindictive God, whom Richard describes, is one version. I think we maybe want to argue about the use of the word vindictive. But, you know, there is also a deeply, deeply ethical God who 3,000 years ago is saying to the Israelites, you have to care about the vulnerable in your society. You have to do your business honestly. You have to look after your workers. You have to care about...
Well, wasn't this what genetically modified skeptic was talking about? Yes, it was.
The immigrant who comes into your society. So to only describe the God of the Old Testament in that way, I think is actually just simplistic and doesn't help us to really engage with the Old Testament.
And again, I'm still waiting for the festival at Edinburgh to arrive out on YouTube, because I know they recorded it, because this, in fact, is what Alistair McGrath is talking about.
As a whole.
Richard, any response?
I accept that, of course. It was a passage that I was... It was semi-tongue-in-cheek, actually, because, when I do public readings of my books, I do it with my wife, and we usually try to get a laugh from the audience early on in our performance, because it sort of lightens up the atmosphere. And that passage we always used when doing the God Delusion readings, right at the beginning, because it does get the audience roaring with laughter, and it sort of makes the puts the audience in a friendly mood simply because they laugh.
Mm.
So there was a sort of, I mean, I think I went on to describe a story of Randolph Churchill, who had a similar reaction. He'd never actually read the Bible before, and he was challenged by Evelyn Waugh and a brother officer during the war to read the Bible. And he kept on exclaiming how horrified he was by God, and so it was a sort of humorous passage. And I do accept that if you look through either the Old Testament or the New Testament, you can certainly find passages of wisdom, passages that one would ethically approve of, tucked in amongst the others that one wouldn't ethically approve of. I suppose I spend a lot of time in America, and I'm very conscious that the bulk of my audience, the audience, not the bulk of them, but the audience that I'm really trying to reach, is largely an American audience. And I presume that both Chris and Josh know how many people in America actually do take the Bible literally. And you have to read the God Delusion through that filter, that I'm actually aiming it, at least partly, at those people in America who are my enemies as a scientist.
In other words, The God Delusion was a political book aimed at American politics, as if this comes as a surprise to no one. So is Richard Dawkins' atheism political? At least his book is, by his own admission. What seems clear is that Ian Hersey Ali's motivation is personal. And for that, rationality rules, and apparently genetically cosmic skeptic don't care. What seems to annoy them is, again, the fact that there is a political overtone to this, that in terms of sort of this participation out in the world, something seems to feel like it's winning as compared to something seems to feel like it's losing. And tides go in and tides come out. Matthew Arnold's, that quote again that John Vervaeke used with me on stage, just played it yesterday, didn't remember they did use that, but also Justin Brierley uses it for his podcast and his book. The reason everybody is making these videos is, of course, spiritual. Because we all have our fingers in the wind, and we all are sort of surfing the spirits and trying to see which way spirits are blowing. My wife and I just started watching the latest season of The Crown on Netflix, and there's this one poignant moment, I believe it's in the second episode of the latest season, where basically Charles and Diana are in a war via the medium of the press. And Charles wants his mother to come to Parker Bowles' birthday party, because to be seen coming to her birthday party, because that would give her legitimacy. But the Queen does not come. But then Lady Diana, she's trying to get the press off her back, and so she poses in a swimsuit, lets the photographers have a good look in exchange. Can you please give us a little bit of respite? And then the newspapers come out, and all you see so often in The Crown, whether it's how well it correlates to the went on physically with respect to newspapers, or mentally or emotionally, in terms of the royal family, I have no idea. I am by no means an expert in them. The only attention I pay to them is through The Crown, and other people have sort of scoffed at the validity of this series, but it's there. And they care so much about what's in the newspapers, about the public imagination, about what everyone thinks, because that kind of back and forth is what will determine, well, will the English get rid of their king, or will they keep him, etc., 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 etc. And of course, this series can't but help but focus on the tensions that arose in all around the story of Charles and Diana. And I'm amazed at how ferociously even Americans continue to participate in that drama. So I very much anticipate her coming book. I will read it with interest. I will buy it. She will make money off of this new book. I see no reason to imagine that she is insincere about her interest in the story. And again, if you follow her words carefully, she's choosing her words very carefully. She's saying, I'm continuing to go into the story, because she recognizes that we all live within a story. And this will come out after the Thanksgiving video where I talk about Grim Grizz and Peter Berger and the Sacred Canopy. In a democracy, this is all moving quite connected. But even before a democracy, it was moving. In this Sunday sermon, I can pull up some of the slides because they're done. I haven't done my rough draft yet. I'll use this illustration again, and I'm even going to use some rationality rules and this fun meme by Mostly Not Working and Glenn Scrivener. And then we're going to get into religion in the ancient world, because before Esarhaddon marched into Egypt, he stopped at Haran and built a temple in order to get the gods on his side so he could have success in conquering Egypt. This is the ancient world. And actually, if you look at everything that's happening with respect to Gaza and Israel now it's sort of receded from the news a little bit, but everything that's happened with Gaza and Israel is all about public opinion. And when Jordan Peterson said that the more Israel wins on the ground, it loses in the spiritual world and the spiritual conversation, because that's what it is. Now, again, when I use that word, a lot of people are confused because they're hearing me as evangelical Christians listening to spiritual in sort of a Cartesian dualism sense. No. All of the back and forth over Hirsi Ali's conversion is in fact spiritual, because they are looking for the movement of the zeitgeist and the mind of the culture. Now, what happens is that when Assyria is weak, Judah tries to stretch it a little bit. And then, of course, Egypt gets conquered, And, well, Judah's in a bad spot, so under Manasseh, what does Manasseh do? Well, it's all Assyrian religion all the time. Temple prostitutes, everything. Manasseh's policy represented a total break with that of Hezekiah and return to Ahaz. Its consequences, especially where religious matters were concerned, were serious. Like his grandfather before him, Manasseh apparently felt impelled to pay homage to his overlord's gods. Altars to astral deities, probably of Mesopotamian origin, were erected within the temple itself. But Manasseh's actions went far further than this and constituted a thoroughgoing reputation of the Reform Party and its works. The local shrines of the Lord, which Hezekiah had attempted to suppress, were restored. Pagan cults, it's religious freedom. Thank you, King Manasseh. Pagan cults and practices, both native and foreign, were allowed to flourish, with apparatus of fertility, religion, and the ritual of sacred prostitution being tolerated even within the temple. Divination and magic, which currently enjoyed enormous popularity in Assyria, were the vogue of Jerusalem, as were the foreign fashions of various sorts. The barbarous rites of human sacrifices again made an appearance. Saturday Night Live had an hilarious skit about... He's thinking about the Roman Empire. He's thinking about the Roman Empire. Does he have another woman? And then it's Rome. But of course, it's our projection sort of back to Rome. And Rome. I thought it was hilarious. And then she's upset. And then she's worried about the little boy. What's the little boy thinking of? Dinosaurs. And of course, Tom Holland posted this because this was Tom Holland's story, of course, from dinosaurs to Rome. And then what are the ladies thinking about? Astrology. And I thought, yeah. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And then, of course, the men come in and, well, you know, the Romans thought about astrology. Yes, they did. All the memes that we've shown, ancient ethics, Christianity, modern ethics. Look how far I've climbed and I'm not even tired. Now, in all fairness, Rationality Rules has a segment in his video where he treats some of this, which would be fun to treat. And maybe I'll do it. I don't know if it'll be worth the time, but... actually, Tom Holland and his book is beginning to have an impact. And this is really where it's going. That's, well, here we are. And this also from Mostly Not Working. And her timing with respect to ARC was dead on the money. Religion is dollars, politics is cents. Religion is always, politics is now. Keep those things in mind because that's what's happening. And we all have these layers. And the new atheism was always about politics. And now, well, the difficulty is having a religion that stays and continue to actually keep up with the times in a real way, not just in terms of always changing itself, but in terms of always being intelligible. Those are the religions that last, and that is sort of Darwinian, but still quite true. So let me know what you think. Leave a comment.